Jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is no joke. It takes years to master.
Martial arts are a vehicle for developing your human potential. And nothing in my life has ever put me in face with reality better than jiu-jitsu.
Training in BJJ offers a powerful lens through which to examine some primary human concerns: truth versus delusion, self-knowledge, ethics, and overcoming fear.
There's more philosophy in our mats than actually philosophy in any Ivy League school.
Welcome to Philosophy.
Hello, everybody.
And welcome to another episode of
Philosophy.
How's it going, bro?
I am chilling like a villain. How are you doing?
I'm absolutely fantastic, man. We have our next guest ready in the wing. Should we bring him on?
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Mr. Robert Dreisel.
What's going on, everyone? Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome, sir. So listen, we're going to ask you the question we ask everyone who comes on this podcast. How did you get into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu?
Oh, man. I was a very competitive teenager who sucked at everything, long story short. And I really wanted to be good at something. And nothing really spoke to me in a very meaningful way until I found Jiu-Jitsu. And then I was like, this is it. And I was not good at all. I sucked. I'm far from talented. I was always like mediocre at everything I've done, you know. But jiu-jitsu is one of those things. I think the beauty of jiu-jitsu is that, of course, athletic ability counts, but it's probably the art where it's most neutralized. You know, you can never be a good sprinter or a good swimmer without a good genetic setting to back up your competition, you know. Like, same thing for, you know, you cannot be, if you're tall, if you're 6 feet tall, you can't be a good gymnast. It's just never going to happen. You're not going to be an elite gymnast. Like, jiu-jitsu is probably one of the few sports in the world where, you know, it doesn't matter what you have, what you were given. There's a way to be good at jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, man.
There is a game that's going to fit your body style, your body type, and, you know, those. And I fell in love with it because it was so complex. Like, I love the fact that it was, you know, we call it the human chess. And that's probably my favorite thing about it. It's a very complex, very rich art on so many different levels. I just fell in love with it, and I didn't know where I was going to go with it, but I knew I had found something special, and I just never looked back. I just had jiu-jitsu to look forward to, and it was immediate, man. It was love at first sight. And, you know, when I was like 19, 20, I remember like my uncles and my dad at one point set me down and like, man, you got to stop it with this karate kid thing. You got to get a job. I'm like, it's not karate. But they, you know, it was, you know, no looking back, sort of, you know, with your shield on and kind of mindset.
Do you remember your first jiu-jitsu experience? Do you remember that first class?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I got my ass kicked by a girl, man. I'll never forget. It was fun. I knew her from school. And I think her name was Gianni, if I recall. And I knew her from school, and I had a huge crush on her, and I knew she was doing jiu-jitsu, and I was interested. I wanted to train. And there was a school that was not too far from my house, and I knew she went there. So it was kind of like, you know, two birds with one stone. I get introduced to jiu-jitsu, and I get to hang out with the cute girl. So I went there, and because we knew each other, the first round, I was paired up with her. She was like a yellow belt. I would have been like 16. She whooped my ass, man. Like, had me in that Kasagatami like headlock, and then it's like, I've never had my head squeezed like that, so I don't know what to do. I'm like, oh, I'm tapping. And then like 2-3 minutes later, same thing. She gets on top of me, gets me the exact same headlock, makes me tap again, and I'm like, all right, I'm probably not very attractive right now. But the second thought was, you know, this stuff really works and this is a lot of fun. And yeah, from that point on, I was very invested right away. It was the only reason I was training once a day is because there were no two classes a day. Otherwise, I'd be doing day right away. Like, it didn't matter if it was raining, if it was sick, what was going on, I'd find a way to get to practice. And yeah, that was it, man. I knew what I wanted.
That's nice. Crazy because like that must have been a long time ago. It's like jiu-jitsu must have been still fresh in America, I'm guessing.
Well, that was in Brazil, actually. My first experience with jiu-jitsu was in 97. It was not like this story I just told you. It was a school. It was like, it's funny because Brazil doesn't have many traditional jiu-jitsu schools. This was one of them. It was in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And that was my first experience. It was like more the Japanese style, right? It was a cross between judo and karate. But that was my first experience with nyuaza or ground fighting. And about, and then that school actually shut down after a few months. So I went to another jiu-jitsu school that was actually Brazilian jiu-jitsu, what we practice today. And it was a whole different ball game, you know, and the guys were much, much better, and it was more specialized on the ground. There was no striking. It was what we call Brazilian jiu-jitsu, right? But that was 98 when I started at this other school. So I would have been 17, more or less. And yeah, it was a while ago. A lot has changed. A lot has changed technically and culturally.
So, Hammond, your first class was in 97. If I'm not mistaken, you won ADCC in 2007?
Correct.
So 10 years, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
10 years later, you're winning the most prestigious Nogi grappling tournament in the world. How did you do that?
Honestly, man, like I was never like the most talented guy. Like I think my superpower was never like, I'm not the most technical guy. I'm not the fastest or the strongest. I'm not the biggest brainiac in this sport. Like there are people that are more thoughtful. They're better strategists than me. I can be quite impulsive when I compete. You know, I think I had good strategy, but there are guys out there that are better than me. But I was just very competitive, man. I think that was my superpower. Like, you know, if I have to give myself something to explain something like ADCC, like it's not an accident. It's not luck, you know. But looking back, I was never the most technical or the most athletic or the most intelligent. I was very, very competitive. Like that was my, like when I went to the gym, like I had to win every single round. Like if someone swept me, I lost my shit. And that, I was always like that. I to my credit, maybe like I never blamed other people when I lost. From a very young age, I always like took responsibility and blamed myself. Like 100% of the blame went on me. I mean, there were times where I complained with the referee, you're human, you know, but you know, most of the thought wasn't into, oh, the world isn't working in my favor. It was more like, I suck. I need to get better. It was like this constant state of anxiety. You know, this anxiety was overwhelming. It's nonstop. It just doesn't stop. And I believe that anxiety over the past is very, very harmful because you can't change the past. Mm. But anxiety over the future is a very, very powerful tool if you know how to use it. And I suffered from that. Like in my head, I had to be the best guy in the gym every day. Like I remember when I started training with Tedede and Eduardo Tellis and Damian Maia and Leo Vieira and those guys. I had just gotten my brown belt. I went to the world as a purple, and I had just gotten my brown belt when I started training with him. And I wasn't doing well. Like, I mean, these guys were beating me. Tedede would beat me. Like, Leo would pass my guard like it wasn't even there, you know? And I remember going home, and it didn't matter that these guys were like legends of the sport. In my head, I had to beat them. And I'm like thinking about this like all day. Like, what am I going to do to, you know, I guess by the wheels are turning 24/7. And I remember, like, I remember telling myself, like, 1 year and I have to be beating every single one of these guys, you know, like that was kind of like the thought process, like, you know, and just constantly raising the bar. I think that's what allowed me to go further than I should have gone had it not been for that. You know, it's the fact that I raised the bar very high for myself very early on, and I never lowered the standard.
Wow, that's quite remarkable. And I think it's quite amazing that you would say that, because I find like, when a lot of athletes are in the sport, like especially in the mainstream, I feel like there is a little bit of pushback and someone coming out and saying like, I just want to be the best. And regardless of, it's like they have to say like, I work hard and luck, almost to be liked. Yeah. But
yeah, I don't believe that. I think that false humility is as harmful as arrogance. You know, I think that, you know, you there's nothing wrong with communicating truthfully. I think that's how you get goodness across. Like, I think lying is just, you're not doing any good. It says, oh, what a nice, I mean, I think that there's people that, you know, there is such thing as arrogance and overconfidence, of course. I'm not suggesting there is, and it's harmful. There's such thing as narcissism. But, you know, if I'm going to, let's say someone's listening and they're wondering, like, how I want to be a champion, like, I don't help them by giving them a fake recipe. I help them by giving them the true recipe that worked for me. And that's the best way I can help them, you know, and it's not, and like I said, I'm not, you know, there are a lot of things that I'm not good at. I'm very impulsive. Like I've always, you know, I'm not the most technical. If you watch me, I'm by far like not the most technical guy. I never was. I'm not the worst, but I'm not the very far from the most technical guy out there. I'm not the most athletic. I'm not the most discipline. Like, I would like to say I'm very disciplined, but like, I always say discipline is doing what you hate, not doing what you love. Doing what you love every day doesn't make you disciplined. Doing what you hate every day makes you disciplined. If I hated running, I would never run. I always make an excuse not to run. Like, I hated running sprints. I do it, but like, not all the time. Yeah. Like, there's a number of things, like drilling. I hated drilling, so I just wouldn't do it. So these things are, you know, like, you know, they're flaws, the things that I could have done better. But at the same time, I know what I did right. I'm aware of the things that worked for me. And in my case, it was just being, I had to be the best guy on the mats everywhere I went. And I wasn't always. Sometimes there were guys that they could beat me. Like when I was in MMA, there were people that didn't stand up that were picking me apart. They were much better than me. But it never, there was never a moment in my head where I accepted that. There was never a moment in my head where I go, oh, it's okay that this guy's better than me. Like in my head, it wasn't okay. You know, like I had to outdo him. And it was a way of like really being in a constant state of anxiety, but also of, I think it helps you get better if you have that sort of approach.
Definitely. And then most recently, turned author as well and filmmaker. My coach actually bought the book that you have written off the back of the film that you're making. And he said, it's time for you to learn the history of our sport. So he threw it at me and told me to go ahead and read it. Give us a quick overview for people that maybe don't know about this. What is this project you've been working on?
Well, it was sort of a spontaneous project. I'm a history major. When I was a kid, I wanted to be, before jiu-jitsu, I wanted to be an academic. I've always liked books. I've always liked reading. I've always liked science. So to me, you know, it came very naturally to me. But, you know, jiu-jitsu took my life on a completely different course. And I decided after retirement that I wanted to get back into school. And I went back to UNLV for a minute. And that was around the time I started becoming more curious about the history of jiu-jitsu, because I only knew the official narrative. I bumped into some books. Like, a student actually challenged me. He's like, why don't you have a picture of Carlos and Helio on the wall?
Yeah.
And I go, well, I don't know anything about jiu-jitsu history. And like, if I know anything about martial arts, is that you should be skeptic towards everything you hear, because martial arts might be the most deceitful business on the planet. I'm not suggesting that, you know, anyone's lying. I'm not accusing anyone, but approaching things with skepticism, I think, is very healthy in general, not just in martial arts and everything we do in life. You should be a little suspicious and do your own research. So a student, you know, is like, but Robert, didn't you go to school for history? Weren't you a history major? I'm like, oh yeah, man, I am. I should probably know more about this than I do. So I started looking into whatever was available. There wasn't a lot. I mean, there's a lot of like Wikipedia, like articles and interviews and general articles on the internet, but like nothing with sources. If you look and you go through the internet, you're not going to find a lot of sources. And there's a reason for that. It's all oral tradition. And if you trace back that oral tradition, it all goes back to Carlos Gracie's testimony. Now, in history, oral tradition is something you got to be very, very careful about. It's valuable, like it's part of the narrative, but you can't take that as the only account, because people are biased. I'm biased, you're biased, we're all biased. And, you know, this is a narrative that is, you know, 100 years old now, and you got to be, you know, you got to be careful with something that's that old and has been handed down, you know, word of mouth. Mm. So when I started, you know, looking at some more serious work out there, I found Roberto Pedreira, I found Marcial Serrano, and I found Josetto Ficaro's PhD dissertation on the history of jiu-jitsu. And they were giving me a very different picture. What they were saying was at odds with everything I'd heard, and I'm like, this is incredible. I never heard of this guy. I didn't know about this. I didn't know about that. Like, there's no such thing as a Gracie Academy in 1925, for example. Carlos Gracie had Brazilian teachers. Like, there were other guys that were instrumental in the history of jiu-jitsu, like George Gracie. He was forgotten. No one talks about him, but he was the first Gracie superstar. He was the first superstar in the family. And this guy is one of the founding fathers of MMA, and no one's ever heard of him. He fought more than all his brothers combined, yet no one's ever heard of him. I'm like, this story is incredible. Like, why does no one know this? And I would ask people, like, do you know about this? And they thought I was crazy. Like, no, you're making that up. I'm like, no, man, here's a newspaper article. And I had to show it to people with like pictures and go like, man, this is legit. Like, I'm not making this up. And the people would be shocked. I'm like, where'd you get that? And it was like, oh, it's the Brazilian National Library. And you can just like search the old newspapers and you can start finding all these files. And I started getting into that for a minute. And I was just like shocked that no one knew any of this. I'm like, and I thought about writing a book at the time. And I'm going, if I write anything, I'm just going to be rewriting what has already been written in terms of research. I don't have, I mean, I found something new here and there, but nothing that was going to really change the narrative significantly. So I feel I would just be republishing what had already been written. And my efforts would be better put into spreading the story as best I could. And I thought a film format was the right way to do that, like a documentary film. And then I started reaching out to these guys. I'm like, hey, man, I want to make a documentary about this. Are you guys interested? And they were very interested. Everyone I spoke to was very supportive. That evolved into finding a film crew. That evolved into finding an investor with ACB. And once we got the funds, we got to work, you know. And the film is still in production. It's a very complicated production for a variety of reasons. A, we have a very small team. B, it is a very complex story, 140 years summarized in 90 minutes. It's very difficult to do. A lot of rights, you have to get rights for every single, use an image for 3 seconds. You have to make sure that image, you have rights to use it. So that's very complicated and tiresome. And there's a lot of back and forth and it's a lot of work. And there's no promise of any money either. Like there's a good chance. I mean, most documentaries don't even break even, just to give you an idea. And I don't think we'll be in that category, but you never know. And, you know, while we're in production and while we're, you know, we're behind schedule during quarantine, I was bored out of my mind and, you know, borderline depressed over everything that was going on. I'm like, the world is going to end. This is back in March last year, right? No one knew what was happening. I sat down and I started writing a book. And it was actually an article. It was an article that evolved. It was an article about my memories of producing the documentary. And it evolved into, you know, 2,000 words turned into 100,000 words very quickly. And I was typing like every day, 8 hours a day for like 3 weeks straight.
Wow.
It was pretty quick. The whole thing was pretty quick because it was already in my head. I just had to put it on paper. Most of the work was actually editing the book, you know, restructuring it, rewriting some things, you know, like inserting the interviews, editing the interviews. That was most of the work, in fact. And that was it. We released a book in October. It's been doing really well. We came out with a Portuguese version about a month ago. We have a Polish version coming out this week.
Wow.
Nice. The latest. And it's being translated into German and Spanish and possibly French and Russian as well. So we're working on all that right now.
That's
so
amazing.
I've started the book. I've got through the initial kind of like introductions and I'm into the first interview. One of the things that I really liked you were talking about is this idea of the truth and the fact that I think you were saying as historians, we kind of agree that we'll circle somewhere around the truth. Like we'll do our best, but we agree that we won't necessarily get to the truth at every step of the way. We're somewhere around the vicinity of it.
Yeah.
Without going into, I guess, too much detail, do you feel like you got to the truth with this story?
Yeah, it's in the exact sciences, you know, you can go, you know, 2 + 2 = 4 and there's no debate. There's no ideological struggle as to whether 2 + 2 = 4. There's no half of academia that says one thing and the other half says something else. Like, you know, but when it comes to the humanities, there's invariably debate because people have different values. They have different senses of justice, different senses of morality, different senses of, you know, what, you know, a decent society would look like. We differ in all these things. We don't agree on these things. So the outcome is not like the four is not always a four. Sometimes it's a three, it's a five. There's always going to be some slack there. It's not something very, very compact. You know, you can't really get to it. You know, even if we all had a time machine and we went back in time, we could witness the French Revolution. And we were like, you know what, you're going to witness it for a whole year, all three of us. And we come back in a time machine and like, okay, write me an essay about what happened. You get three different accounts. Mm-hmm. And if you had 100 people doing the same thing, you get 100 different accounts. So what's the truth? So in history, you don't get to the truth. What you do get is, like you said, you gravitate around it, and this is as close as we can get. I truly believe that considering what we have in print, what is available out there, what has been published, I think we came as close as possible to it. Like, and I mean, there are things that could have been better or different here and there, but marginal. I think in the grand scheme of things, we're as, you know, compared to what, considering what's published and, you know, and with the sources available and all that, I think we're very close.
Yeah. I do have many questions, many, many questions. I guess in my mind, the fact that, and again, do correct me if I'm wrong, you're, you know, you have the half that is Brazilian and also the half that is American. In my mind, you almost and you studied history and you're a very high level jiu-jitsu competitor, you're almost perfectly placed in this scenario to go in and you know, uncover what this history was. I suppose my questions revolve around, what was the response from the community like? And was there any kind of trepidation on your part, especially when you started to discover things that weren't very publicly available?
I think there was some concern in the beginning that I was going to burn some bridges and lose some friends, you know. But at the same time, like I've always firmly believed that if you don't like a fact, you're the one with the problem, not the fact. Mm. If I give you a fact and you don't like it, like, I'm the kind of guy that if you have bad breath and if you ask me, hey, Rob, do I have bad breath? I'm 100% always going to tell you, because I don't think, how else do I help you? Lying to you, you know, if it doesn't go well in relationships, your girlfriend asks you, am I overweight? I'm like, I would tell her the truth. You'd be better off if you lost 10 pounds. Like, you know, but, you know, it doesn't always sit well, but I think it's a better way of dealing. I would rather be around people like that. You know, like if you're interested in progress, that's what you need. You need to hear some hard things, like some things you're going to hear about yourself you're not going to like. So, you know, I love jiu-jitsu. I love what jiu-jitsu has done for me. Jiu-jitsu turned me into a man. Like, it turned me into someone I'm proud of being. I wanted to give something back, and that meant that the only way I can help jiu-jitsu is trying to clarify this as much as possible. Initially, there was some kickback. There was a lot of, like, you know, people writing me hate mail. Oh, I actually got messages like, oh, you're only doing this because you lost to Roger and you hate the Gracie family. Like, no, I actually admire the guy. I think he's incredible. Like, actually, no, I have a lot of respect for many members of the Gracie family. Some did more harm than good, if you ask me. Not everyone was helpful, but most of them were very, not most of them, but the ones that are known are very important to this story, and I don't neglect that. I just think that oral tradition is something that you have to be careful with, and any historian would tell you the same thing. No one's going to say, you take one account and you make that the whole story and you'll be fine. I'm like, that's not how it works. You need thousands of sources, you know, and then you're going to have someone close to what you're looking for. So, you know, and then it kind of stopped. I think it stopped. The people that didn't like it, they really quickly realized they weren't going to be able to confront this with better facts or other narratives, that it was something they couldn't challenge. So they were just going to ignore is the strategy. So the people that aren't content with this narrative, they're just going to ignore. There's nothing else they can do. And then, you know, people that initially were very suspicious have become supportive over time. But it was a lot of work because, you know, the first thing that comes across is, oh, Robert's a hater and he's just trying to promote himself off of a hate speech, you know, like, or attacking people that, and I think that a lot of people still have that perception. But I think if you read the book, and certainly when you watch the film, it's not like that at all. I'm very surprised if someone reads the book and feels that I'm attacking anyone, where I'm being, you know, purposefully, you know, deceitful in any way, or I don't have a hidden agenda. I think that's very clear if you read the book that I don't have an agenda here.
Did you ever question whether you should do this, whether you may, without meaning to, inadvertently cause more harm than good?
No, not at all. That question never came. That's funny. I never even thought about that. Like, first time, the first person asked that question. Not for a second. I do think that, you know, there's a part of me in mid-production, because it's been a very difficult production. There's a part of me like, man, I could just be focusing on myself and making money here, doing what everyone else is doing. Here I am spending a shitload of my time doing something because I love jiu-jitsu, you know, and financially speaking, it's been very detrimental to my life.
It would be a weird motivation for you to want to cause any harm. It would be a weird thing for you to want to do, given the situation you have now found yourself in.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm very confident there was no like ill intent, because I have not a lot to gain. Like, what do I, I mean, okay, maybe, you know, I give some interviews, I sell some books, maybe the film takes off. But if money is your motivation, I think we can all agree that making a documentary is not the fastest way to do it. Yeah. No one's ever gotten money. Money were really my motivation here. Like, I wouldn't be doing jiu-jitsu to begin with. I'd be a land developer. I'd be at Wall Street. I'd be like into the finance world. That's where the money is. You know, I'm just not interested in that world, so I don't go there. I'm interested in jiu-jitsu. So if I happen to make any money from anything I do, it's a side effect. It's never a goal. Like, no one should enter jiu-jitsu to make money. You're out of your mind. When I hear these kids talking about, like, I'm going to make so much money from jiu-jitsu, and they're bragging about it. I'm like, they're a true moron. Like, if money is your motivation, you're in the wrong business. I don't know how else to say it. Yeah. Like, you're in the wrong business, man. Like, you got to go somewhere else. Like, you do jiu-jitsu for different reasons. And if you make some money, that's a side effect. But I think a lot of people miss that.
You know, in Portuguese, there is a saying, quem conta conto aumenta sempre mais ponto, right? Like, sort of like, who tells a...
So slowly for me.
Whoever tells a tale always adds a dot, you know, like an extra dot. So adding more. And I'm wondering, as you were going from interview to interview, what were the things that surprised you more and more? Like, oh my God, like that stood out for you? And what are the ways that making this book and this documentary changed you the most?
Oh man, big question. A number of things surprised me throughout the interviews. One of them was, you know, how neglected these grandmasters were. Mm. Like, I was surprised. I'm like some of these guys that were so excited to talk to us. And I'm thinking, wait a second, like, you don't have people coming here every week to talk to you. And it was obvious that that wasn't the case. Like, some of them probably hadn't been interviewed in years. Mm. I mean, who knows how long, you know, I didn't ask, but they were so happy to tell their story. They were so happy to be remembered. It was almost sad, you know, because these are the guys that should be put on pedestals, like, not like these 22-year-olds that don't. I mean, like, I don't want to sound like old man, but like, as good as you may be at jiu-jitsu, you normally don't have anything to say. I mean, pick your champion, like, give me some life advice or some wisdom. They don't have anything to teach you. They're good at jiu-jitsu, they can teach you moves. But here are people that not only laid the groundwork for MMA and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu to exist, but they actually have something to teach well beyond just techniques, you know? So I took that. I saw a piece there, man. Like, it was a very beautiful thing because, you know, people like Armando read it and Henzo's father, Hobson Grace, he was a patriarch of the Gracie family today. They couldn't be more different. They're completely different people. But at the end of their journey, and they're approaching the end of their journey, in the case Armando, he passed away a couple of years ago, right after we interviewed him, you know, but I think at the end of their journey, they all feel the same way about life. You know, they had this happy outlook on things, like, life is worth living, and it sucks many times and it's hard, but at the end, it's worth it. At the end, it's good and it's worth living. And they were completely content if they died the next day and they, you know, that's it. They would both be leaving this world with a smile on their face. And that's what I got from them. I kept thinking to myself, man, I hope I can get there one day. That's how I want to be at the end. Like, the last feeling I want to have before I go is a feeling of happiness. Of, it was, overall, it was good, and I'd do it all over again. Like, I'd live my life the exact same way all over again. And I got that from these guys. And that was probably one of the biggest takeaways, if not the biggest one.
How rare is that, right? Yeah. To be able to say I'd live my life exactly how I wanted to live it. Rob, it's probably worth letting you know that both Iki and I are involved in video making ourselves.
Okay.
Yeah, Iki has just done his master's at London Film School. Nice. And I've been a video producer now for 10 years.
Oh, nice.
Have you, before you embarked on this film, did you have any video making experience before in your life?
I couldn't even edit videos for Instagram.
Amazing. Wow.
Struggle on my phone trying to edit stuff. My only experience with film was watching them, and not even that many. It's not like I'm one of those guys that's seen every documentary. I'd see a documentary here and there, and I always liked them because I thought they were very informative. But I've never been like a movie fanatic. I've never been, no experience whatsoever. It was more, and it wasn't problematic because probably some blind spots on my end, not understanding the something that you guys would understand. I walked into this executive producer as a white belt, you know, with no understanding of the difficulty of post-production, no understanding of how much things would cost or how much work would be. And I certainly made, I walked into this with the mind of a historian. Like, my experience comes from, you know, I'm not a professional historian, but that was my part of my role here, was being the guy that was going to help get across this story. So to me, it was all about information. And I think I missed out. Initially, I was always like more leaning towards information over aesthetics. But a film is both. A documentary film is both. You can't miss the mark and over. You can't be too worried about aesthetics and miss the content because you're not going to teach anything. And if you're too worried about teaching too much, you're going to lose your audience. So it's a very difficult balance. And I think that we struck the film is ready. We just can't release it yet for a variety of reasons, but there's still some polishing to do, but we have a final version. It's just not picture lock. And I think we found a very good balance. I'm confident that, because if you're a jiu-jitsu researcher or historian and you know the story inside out, you're probably going to be disappointed, because you can't tell 140 years of history in 90 minutes. It's impossible. It's very like scraping the surface, give you Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu history 101 kind of lesson. You know, and we knew that from the beginning. We're not going to, if we go in too much depth there, it's going to be boring. It's going to be too many newspaper articles. And, you know, the historians and the researchers, they knew the most by far. Like, they were the most familiar people with this story. But there's something more impactful about having a 92-year-old tell his memories of how jiu-jitsu started. Like, it's not the same. Like, when he's telling the story of how jiu-jitsu started, it is so much better than a historian who's like my age talking about all the books he read.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the same, even though they're more knowledgeable. They know far more than the people that actually lived it. Like, people don't realize this, but a historian is infinitely more knowledgeable than an eyewitness. People don't seem to get that. Like, no, there's no way the guy was there. He knows more. I'm like, no, he doesn't. He has one opinion, his own. A historian is building off of thousands of sources with the methodology. You can't compare the two. But it's not the same as far as like the impact of for the audience would be, right? So we were aware of this, and it was a lot of balancing things out, man. A lot of editing. Some things that people would say are just incorrect, and we had to edit it out. And it feels terrible. Like, you're telling him he's wrong. I'm like, yeah, he's wrong. We're gonna have to edit that, because we didn't want anything that was in the book. Some of it makes it in because I wanted a glimpse of the official narrative so people could see, but we corrected in the main text. But in terms of the documentary, I didn't want anything that we couldn't back up.
There's so many things that come to mind there. The first of all is the infamous rule number one of Pixar, which is story is king. Mm. I think they had like a set of rules that they always followed, and number one was story. And the second is, when I was studying film at university, I was reading a book on editing, and one editor said, there's a million ways to cut a film, but only one right way. I thought that was the perfect way to sum up the process.
And also killing your darlings, right?
Because like,
That are parts that you like more than anything else, but maybe they don't add to the film as a whole, so you have to let go of it.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
That I know, and I learned that. I mean, I had learned that you're going to have to cut things you love. And in the book, we did too. I actually battled my editor at some point, because like, there are things that it probably didn't belong. I'm like, no, I want that to go in there. And I have a hard time letting go of things that are meaningful to me, you know? And it's a very difficult thing to do. But you're right. In filmmaking, you have to cut things that you absolutely love. And we've done a lot of that. And I've made my peace with it, you know? Even if this is well, I'll probably come out with an extended version in the future. Like, I'll have an extended, like a longer one, maybe 2 hours instead of 90 minutes, assuming it does, you know, as well, and we can afford it. As you guys know, post-production is very, very expensive.
It's the one everyone forgets. It's the one no one saves money for, but it's where the film happens ultimately.
Yeah. And I walked into this thinking, oh, filming all the tickets and hotel rooms, that's what's going to be expensive. Well, like, that was like 10% of
our 10% expenses.
But people don't realize that, and I would have never guessed either. Like, you know, so I was very, very ignorant. It was more, I guess I'm overconfident about things that I can do sometimes, but at the same time, it kind of makes me, not scared of throwing myself out there.
Well, that's it. You did it, right? You didn't sit on this. You went out and did it.
Yeah, because if you knew how long it was going to take, maybe you'd have over time be like, maybe I'll give it a few more years and let it happen. Yeah.
Had I known how much time it was going to take and how stressful it was going to be, I might have turned into a coward. I might have broken me before the film even started. I was ignorance actually worked in my favor in this case.
But it's interesting you mentioned that one day you may release the extended features. I mean, you've got it right. You've committed it to celluloid. We now have at least the records. You know, so that this is completely your decision. It's your film. You own the materials. As a historian, you've documented it, right? You know, in the same way that you go out, you release a paper, you write a book, you do all this. You've committed these interviews, and as you say, from some people that are nearing the end of their journey, we now have documented records of this. So even if it doesn't make the film, like you said, we still have those now, archival footage at least.
Yes, I think that, you know, it was the timing was right too. And I mentioned this in the book. I don't know if you got to that part, but there is a window of time there between these first generation passing away. And we've lost five of these grandmasters, just to give an idea of how urgent this project is and the digitization of all the files in the National Library. So 10 years ago, no research. 10 years from now, no grandmasters. So we found a happy window. We were able to get the research, and we were able to get the very first practitioner still alive to interview them. So it was a very small window of time. And like, it was an accident. I wasn't aware of that initially, but halfway through the production, we were, man, like, we really came into this at the right time. Like, we were almost too late, you know, because we lost. So, I mean, ideally we would have done this 10 years ago. We wouldn't have had any historians to say anything because no one knew anything. Yeah. 10 years ago, the files weren't digitized. Like, what are you going to say? You're going to just repeat the official narrative. So there would have been nothing would have been added to this history. So it was very fortunate, man. Like, we have the records. Now it's out there. I don't know. We have so much footage, man. We have like something like 20 terabytes of
footage. Oh, my God.
Did your editor know when you came back with it? Like, were they ready?
What we filmed, between pictures, between, you know, archival stock footage, everything, approximately 20 terabytes.
Wow.
So, it's beefy. You know, we have a one-man army editing right now. So you can imagine how much work that is for him. So that explains why we're late. It's that we're looking into hiring more people to try to speed up the process. But it's just a lot, man. We don't, and like I said, there's only one perfect version. Like, we can have a half-assed version right now. Like, we would rather wait and come out with the right one. And that's kind of where we're at right now, is really trying to make this as good as it can be.
It's so crazy, like, how important the movie is, because we're literally, like, if you didn't make this movie and we're just talking to you, we'd be talking about all your fights in ADCC, all your experience in jiu-jitsu, which is mind-blowing.
Which we'd love to talk about anyway.
Exactly. It's like mind-blowing on its own. But I think the fact that with all that experience, you make going out and actually trying to tell this story kind of brings credibility. I think not in a sense of, oh, I'm telling the story, but, oh, let's have this conversation, guys. Let's be more curious about the story of jiu-jitsu. Because that is the thing that doesn't happen as much about.
No, and the thing to remember is, no one remembers a late film, but they'll always remember a bad film. So, I think I've just ripped that from the guy who created Nintendo. He said about games, but it's so true. It's so true.
No, and that's kind of our, I mean, I'm not too happy with the fact that it's late. I can be like somewhat OCD when it comes to time frames and things like that. But at the end of the day, I would rather err on the side of being late than err on like, okay, that didn't hit the spot. You know, that wasn't like the we want a home run. And I think we're close to a home run. We're working towards one. I mean, who knows? You know, I didn't know Netflix is coming out with a production on the history of jiu-jitsu as well. I don't know if you guys know that.
Right. No.
I actually spoke to the director like once on the phone, and like, not to offend the guy, but he just doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, like, historically speaking, he's just very, very off. And they're going to repeat the official narrative, which is very incorrect. Like, they're going to make Maeda this like huge character. Maeda is a marginal character in history of jiu-jitsu reality. Maeda is like the most exaggerated person in this whole story. Everyone obsesses over him. But if you really get down to what he did, he opened a gym and then he left it to his students. That's the extent of his involvement in what we now call Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But, you know, they're going to make the story large about him. So it's going to be way off. But, you know, if we release it at the same time, it could help, because it's a huge Netflix production. So, like, you know, some of the lateness might work in our favor. There are many things that being late will actually help. Meanwhile, the book is out there, you know, so people can learn. I mean, the book is going to be more depth than the film, no doubt. So if you really geek out on this stuff like I do, then the book is probably going to be, it's going to be far more informative than the book. I recommend other readings too. So if there are other things you want to get even more down the rabbit hole, you can go do some of the readings that I did, you know, before I got into this film. And they're available on Amazon. It's not, they're not hidden. It's just that, you know, they're heavy reads. They're not short, easy stories. They're very loaded with data and numbers and dates and people, and it's just a lot. It's very it's a very heavy read, but it's worth it if you really like stuff. That's what I recommend people do.
When the film does come out, is it going to be, how are you going to release it? Is it going to be a cinema release? Is it going to be online?
We've gone back and forth on this on our website, on YouTube. We don't know. There's a very good chance we're going to enter the film festival circuit because we have something that is appealing enough to enter the film festival circuit. Maybe get nominated, maybe win some awards. Like, that would be incredible for the film. It would be a dream. I mean, I'm a rookie, man. I'm a wife, but why would I be receiving an award for something I know nothing about, right? But that would be amazing. I think that would help sell the film, too. We'd probably approach a Netflix tomorrow and, like, hey, man, this is what we are. This is what we've done. What do you guys, you know, so there's a chance that this could be much bigger than we actually originally intended it to be. And that's kind of what we have our eyes on now, because we really got a good story and we really have the footage we have is incredible. Yeah. Like, we got incredible interviews, like the background, the people we have, the fact that they're passed away, a lot of them have passed away. And by the time we release, who knows, maybe more of them will be gone. So all of this sort of plays out in our favor if we hit a home run. So that's why we're polishing this as much as possible. And not, I was more in a hurry 2 months ago than I am now, to be frank, like three months ago. Now I'm more home run. That's what we want.
What did the director from Netflix, how did he take the conversation?
You know, you can be really skilled at some, because I originally offered to, like, I want to do a Hollywood, I mean, I want to do a big production. These guys, like, they're like big time producers. And I'm like, let's do something big. Let's do a film, like a movie, like, you know, a motion picture, not just documentary. And, you know, I'll be working as a consultant, basically. And the thing about, like, being an expert at something, it can make you overconfident that you're expert at everything. And that's certainly, I've been guilty of that more times than I can count. I think we all do that. You're a successful attorney, you think you know medicine. You're a successful doctor, you think you know jiu-jitsu. Like, people, you can be overconfident about things. And he's a very successful director, but I think it makes him overlook the importance of history and, like, how writing history accurately is very, very important. I'm sorry, guys, just getting a call here really quick. Just decline it. There we go. So, like, it was kind of disappointing because, you know, when I mentioned, look, a lot of what we know about Maeda is incorrect. I'm trying to let him know, hey, man, you're going to tell something that's not true. And then he goes, oh, don't worry about it. We found his family in Japan, so they're going to tell us his story. I'm like, you think his great-grandchildren in Japan know anything about him? They're going to repeat what they read on Wikipedia. When you found them, you messaged them. They didn't even know they had a great-grandfather that did judo. Probably went on Wikipedia, read the Wikipedia article and go, oh, yeah, we got this. We'll tell you what happened. And I'm like, you don't know. Yeah. Because, you know, how much do you know about your great-grandfather's life?
And are they making a documentary as well?
No, they're making a fiction film, I think.
Series, I think, about Hickson Gracie and Maeda. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a Rocky Balboa-like story, but historically it's going to be complete. I can almost guarantee you it's going to be inaccurate because they don't have historians as consultants. And when you go that route, like, how can you be? It's like, let's come up with a new, you know, medicine here, but with no scientists involved. Like, let's come out with, like, let's teach a jiu-jitsu class with no jiu-jitsu experts. Like, we can. It's a free country, but what kind of result can you expect when you do that? You know, I think it's shocking that they would want to do a film like that and not have anyone that knows what they're talking about involved. It's truly like, dude, all right, but it will work in our favor because it's just going to bring more eyes on our film. So indirectly, this benefits us tremendously. So ideally, we'd release it around the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I have confidence in the community that they will back this over an inaccurate film. The question is, you've got to get it out there. You've got to get the story out there. You need the community to be digesting it and realizing it. Because, you know, Netflix are Netflix and they could be poised to do more damage than good at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, the community has been somewhat supportive. The thing is that because we're so immersed in the jiu-jitsu bubble, we don't realize we're not that many.
That's so true.
Like, the other day, just out of curiosity, because the book has been for sale at my gym for, like, since mid-October, right? So it's been, like, you know, 4 or 5 months now. My students have had time to buy it. And I noticed that we're not really selling that many books. So I'm like, fine, I'll order all these books here for the gym. And I'm thinking that they're going to fly off the shelf because they're my students, right? And I asked, like, I had like 30 students in my class, like, raise your hand if you have read my book. and one of them raised their hand out of 30.
So did you give him a stripe? Please tell me you gave him a stripe.
Seriously, like, I'm your coach, and you're like, you know, but like, the truth is, most people don't care. Most people don't read. Most people don't care. And when it comes to all the people train, there are many people who train jiu-jitsu, but how many people really care about who's beating who on flow grab? We're talking 5% of the community here. The vast majority are moms and dads and kids and people who just don't care that much. You know, they'd rather watch football on the weekend. So the community, as long as we don't really have a lot of practitioners, like the hardcores, guys like me and you guys, it's less than 5%. Mm. So we're aware of that too. So this is for, that's another thing. We want to make it a film about not just the niche Brazilian jiu-jitsu market, a broader audience that enjoys martial arts in general. Like, people that would watch a film on Bruce Lee would also watch our documentary. So we have the concern of not limiting ourselves to a niche market, but making a film that is watchable to a much broader audience. And that's important in terms of, you know, like the how the film will be received to the general public. Because if we go too historical and too informative, we're going to ostracize that audience who has no idea who Helio Gracie is. So we can't presume that the audience knows who Helio Gracie is. Like, I know you guys know, but I think most of our viewers will never have heard of him.
That's true.
Yeah. So we have to, with that in mind. And so it's just a lot, man. It's just like so many things to think about.
One thing that's quite interesting is you're almost half Brazilian at this point, because you lived in Brazil, right, for a long time.
Well, I'm half Brazilian. My mom's Brazilian. I was raised in Brazil. I went to school there, elementary, high school, and college, all in Brazil. I was never educated in English language. I learned how to read and write when I moved here as an adult. I didn't know how to read and write.
Wow. Nice. I always thought that you're a gringo who knew Portuguese very well. That's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, like, in Brazil, I'm seen as an American. In the U.S., I'm seen as a Brazilian.
Neither here nor there.
Wow. And one thing we always ask our guests, right? It's like you're talking about your students. Is I think you had the experience of seeing jiu-jitsu growing so much, from training with the Teres and Demian Maia till today. It's just like jiu-jitsu has changed so much. And I wonder, like, if you meet a white belt and you have 6 months to train him, even to get ready to a competition, this person has never trained before, and you have to teach him in 6 months, what do you show him?
I don't know. I think the technique thing is, you know, it's important, but it's not, if you really want to be good at jiu-jitsu, it's your mind that's got to change. It's not the technique. Like, you know, I know this because I've seen many champions. Okay, think of your top 10 favorite competitors. Is their jiu-jitsu the same? No, it's completely different, right? They're all different. You know, the guy who arguably has the most successful career of all time, arguably the best grappler of all time, is Roger, arguably, right? Look at his jiu-jitsu. It's so simple.
Yeah.
There's complicated about it. Like, you know, everything he's doing, you know. There's nothing he's doing like, oh, I had no idea what he's doing over there. I'm sure he would show you a detail that is hidden that you don't, you know, I'm sure, he, you know, it's, but if you look at what he's doing overall, there's nothing complicated. And then you see guys like, you know, like Paul Lumiao and Mike Musumesi, who are very complicated, very sophisticated jiu-jitsu. Like, man, that's something, like, slow down. You know, like, what is he doing there? And you have to watch it again and again. And they're both champions. So what's the common denominator? Well, it's not the technique. It's not that they're not technical. It's not, of course, they're very technical. But what they're practicing is so different. But why they're both, what makes them a champion is not the technique they're practicing. There's something else there. I would focus on that white belt and try to teach him a mindset on how to get good over the technique. Because the technique is a product of practice. You're going to practice. You're going to develop a style. It's just a matter of time, you know. And frankly, I'm not one of those. I don't think you need that much information. I think there's an over-focus on information, and there's people are under-focused on training their mind, which is the most important thing. Like, the more I think about this, the more I realize the people are winning. It has less to do with their technique. It has more to do with their mindset, how they look at things. You know, and that right there is, it's hard to change, because if I say, hey, you need to get stronger arms, You know, you can go to a workout room and it's easy to get stronger arms, but like, how do you grow your confidence? It's not an easy equation. How do you improve your confidence? It's very difficult. Like, you know, but you have to reset your mind, and that's something that no one can really do for you. You got to do yourself. But that's what it takes. Like, you have to get rid of hesitation. You have to get rid of insecurities. You know, how do you do that? It's a difficult thing to do, but that's what I would try to teach. And once they have that recipe, I think just mat time will do the rest.
I love wow. that. Yeah, I'm in for that. Sign me up.
Wow, that's...
That's the one.
I'm actually letting that sink in.
Robert, thank you so much for your time. Usually at this point in the podcast, we offer the space up if there's anything you'd like to add, anything you want to just reach out to people and say.
If you ever want to visit me in Las Vegas, I have what I call an open door policy. Everyone's welcome to come. Everyone's welcome to leave if you're not happy. It's sort of like that. I try to cultivate like a good culture in the gym where we have an environment where we have moms and dads and UFC champions all training under the same roof. And it's a very hard thing to do because they're very different cultures and they want different things. But I think we've found a very happy balance at the gym. So I'm very proud of that. And it's probably one of my biggest accomplishments. I think we have a very good culture in the gym. You know, I think we do a really good job at weeding out the bad and make sure that people in there stay, you know, they fall in line with what my vision of what martial arts should be. So if you're ever in Vegas, you're welcome to visit. If you're interested in the book, you can go to closedguardfilm.com. Closedguardfilm.com. You can order a copy. We have Portuguese and English versions up. And some of the more information of the film on the website. Subscribe. We're going to be giving some email updates soon. I'm just working on that email list. I'm spread very thin right now. At the moment, I'm a one-man army. But we're planning on giving the people who subscribe to our email list an update soon. And that's it, you know. Thank you guys for the opportunity. You can follow me on social media too, at Robert Drysdale, JJ. And let's see. That's it, guys. I mean, if there's anything else, you know, if you guys ever want to do this again, more than happy to do so. I hope you guys had fun.
We did.
Immense amount of fun. Yeah. And I'm not sure I can turn down an invitation to Robert Drysdale's gym, especially as it's in Las Vegas. Robert, thank you so much for giving up your time, especially when you're such a busy man. We supremely appreciate it. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, man.
Have a great one.
All the best, my man. Take care.